like to welcome all of you to the New York Society Library, the oldest library in the city, the first Library of Congress where George Washington took his books out. And I'm happy to be a trustee of this great library. And now it's annual fund season. So I'd like to remind you all to give as generously as you can to help support wonderful programs like tonight and all the many services the library offers. And tonight, we are very proud to be presenting J.D. McClatchy and his wonderful new book, Plundered Hearts, New and Selected Poems. I met Sandy 35 years ago at Books and Company when James Merrill presented him to me as a wonderful poet. And he certainly has lived up to that over the years, and it's very impressive. We have these books over here, but Sandy has actually written many more. Some of these are from the Chase collection, Lynn, who's given us a wonderful poetry collection, but she couldn't bear to give up some of his books, so they're still in Lynn's apartment. And so he has so many accomplishments that if I were going to tell you all of them, we'd be sitting here for hours and hours, so I'm going to tell you very briefly. He is known as a poet of urbanity and intellect in the tradition of James Merrill, Auden, and Elizabeth Bishop. Mr. McClatchy is the author of 8 books of poetry and a volume of selected poems, as well as several collections of essays. He has edited nearly 20 books, among them my personal favorite, which we have over there, Horace, the Odes, New Translations by Contemporary Poets. He's been involved also in the music world for many years, including 8 opera libretti performed in opera houses around the world for composers which include Ned Roram and Lauren Maisel. He is also known as an editor, teacher, and critic. His honors include an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, fellowships from the Guggenheim and the National Endowment for the Arts. He's a lecturer at Yale and is a great ambassador for poetry with his brilliant talks on both contemporary and classic poets. In fact, I'm sure Sandy could make a discussion of the most boring subject fascinating. Anthony Hecht had this to say: "There is no poet writing whose intelligence, dexterity, wit, or depth of thoughtfulness or feeling is greater or more telling than J.D. McClatchy." So now let us welcome.
Thank you. So which boring subject would you like to hear about tonight? I'm very happy to be back in the Society Library, and particularly under the wide and velvety wing of Lynn Chase, who has been the most exuberant and generous champion of poetry in this city for many years. As Jeanette mentioned, she's recently given her extensive poetry collection, but I know that the one book that she's keeping back as long as possible is that book that George Washington never did return that he had borrowed here. They're hoping that she'll give that. Writing a selected poems is not writing it, selecting them, and you try to weed out all the hollow and false ones, and you're left with what you think is your best work but that forces you to look at it a little more closely, and you begin to see the flaws in it. But it was also a chance to think back with enormous gratitude to the poets whose way of using words to look at the world had been an important guide to my own apprenticeship. You spend a lot of time trying to copy these people, and then a lot of time trying to take a branch and in the snow and erase all of the footprints, but they're there nonetheless. And I thought actually what I would like to do is read a poem each by 4 of the poets who have meant the most to me over the years. That is W.H. Auden, Robert Lowell, Anthony Hecht, and James Merrill. This is, of course, as you can understand, a fool's errand. Reading these poems and then trying to read one's own, they will just, little tiny moths that I have on little jeweled leashes, just lead them toward these giant flames that I'll start with. But there it is, nonetheless. I've written about this little anecdote up once, and at the risk of boring those who may have known it, I just want to set this up by recounting a little allegorical anecdote. When Auden was to leave the country and move back to England at the end of his life, 1970 or so, he made a farewell tour, reading tour of the States. He came to Yale, where I was a graduate student. In the common room in Pearson College, huge thing. It was mobbed. I forget how I got in. There were no seats, of course, but I ended up on the floor at Auden's feet. I do not remember what he read, but I remember that he had mismatched socks because I was looking at them so intently. When the reading was over, the master of the college, John Hersey, the distinguished writer, was leading Auden back to the master's house for strong drink, and I rushed up to Mr. Auden as he was crossing the yard and said, one's 20 enthusiastic way, "Oh, Mr. Auden, would you sign my book?" So let me interrupt this to say this is about 50 years ago. 50 years ago, nearly 50 years ago, I was not a bad-looking young thing. Not the wreck, gray, fat thing you see before you tonight, but attractive, I guess you'd say, in a conventional way. So I hand Mr. Auden the copy of his book to sign, and he looks me over like this and says, "Turn around and bend over." Which of course I did, because who wouldn't? But of course, what it was is that Auden wanted to use my back as a desk so he could write. See what you were thinking? Naughty, naughty boys and girls. Anyway, it was a kind. I mean, if I said that, it's a kind of thrill to have been used as a desk by a great writer, and that's the way with all these other writers. I feel part of my luck is to be a way they can keep writing. In one way or another, or keep being written. So, let me read these four poems. This is the longest and the best. All of these poems were written while I was alive, and you, this one in 1952, called The Shield of Achilles. Achilles was one of the spoiled children of legend, because, his mother dipped him into the river Styx, which was supposed to prevent him ever dying, but has held him by the heel as she dipped him in, so he was eventually killed by the poisoned arrow in his heel. She also, when he was about to invade Troy, went to the smithy god, Hephaestus, to have a spectacular shield made of him. The first work of art that's described in literature is this imaginary shield of Achilles. Auden's poem of this, Achilles' mother was the nymph Thetis, and Hephaestus, the god, they figure in the poem, and she went, in Auden's version, to ask for this spectacular shield, and instead Hephaestus made for her a vision of modern life that is altogether different. The Shield of Achilles. She looked over his shoulder for vines and olive trees, marble well-governed cities, and ships upon untamed seas. But there, on the shining metal, his hands had put instead an artificial wilderness and a sky like lead. A plain without a feature, bare and brown, no blade of grass, no sign of neighborhood, nothing to eat and nowhere to sit down. Yet, congregated on its blankness, stood an unintelligible multitude, a million eyes, a million boots in line, without expression, waiting for a sign. Out of the air, a voice without a face, proved by statistics that some cause was just, in tones as dry and level as the place. No one was cheered, and nothing was discussed. Column by column in a cloud of dust, they marched away, enduring a belief whose logic brought them somewhere else to grief. She looked over his shoulder for ritual pieties, white flower-garlanded heifers, libation and sacrifice. But there on the shining metal where the altar should have been, she saw by his flickering forge light quite another scene. Barbed wire enclosed an arbitrary spot where bored officials lounged. One cracked a joke, and sentries sweated, for the day was hot. A crowd of ordinary decent folk watched from without and neither moved nor spoke as three pale figures were led forth and bound to three posts driven upright in the ground. The mass and majesty of this world, all that carries weight and always weighs the same, lay in the hands of others. They were small and could not hope for help, and no help came. What their foes liked to do was done. Their shame was all the worst could wish. They lost their pride and died as men before their bodies died. She looked over his shoulder for athletes at their games, men and women in a dance moving their sweet limbs quick, quick to music. But there on the shining shield, his hands had set no dancing floor, but a weed-choked field. A ragged urchin, aimless and alone, loitered about that vacancy. A bird flew up to safety from his well-aimed stone. That girls are raped, that two boys knife a third, were axioms to him who had never heard of any world where promises were kept or one could weep because another wept. The thin-lipped armorer, Hephaestus, hobbled away. Thetis of the shining breasts cried out in dismay at what the god had wrought to please her son, the strong, iron-hearted, man-slaying Achilles, who would not live long. If I could have written any poem, I think it would be that one. I'm going to skip Robert Lowell, as history seems to have in the last few decades. And maybe James Merrill as well. But just read the one poem by Anthony Hecht, which was written in the late 1960s. The first poem in his first big collection in 1968. It's called A Hill. In Italy, where this sort of thing can occur, I had a vision once. Though you understand it was nothing at all like Dante's or the visions of saints, and perhaps not a vision at all. I was with some friends, picking my way through a warm, sunlit piazza in the early morning. A clear fretwork of shadows from huge umbrellas littered the pavement and made a sort of lucent shallows in which was moored a small navy of carts. Books, coins, old maps, cheap landscapes, and ugly religious prints were all on sale. The colors and noise, like the flying hands, were gestures of exultation, so that even the bargaining rose to the ear like a voluble godliness. And then, when it happened, the noises suddenly stopped and it got darker. Pushcarts and people dissolved, and even the great Farnese Palace itself was gone for all its marble. In its place was a hill, mole-colored and bare. It was very cold, close to freezing, with the promise of snow. The trees were like old ironwork gathered for scrap outside a factory wall. There was no wind, and the only sound for a while was the little click of ice as it broke in the mud under my feet. I saw a piece of ribbon snagged on a hedge, but no other sign of life. And then I heard what seemed the crack of a rifle, a hunter, I guessed. At least I was not alone. But just after that came the soft and papery crash of a great branch somewhere unseen falling to earth. And that was all, except for the cold and silence that promised to last forever, like the hill. Then prices came through and fingers, and I was restored to the sunlight and my friends. But for more than a week, I was scared by the plain bitterness of what I had seen. All this happened about 10 years ago. And it hasn't troubled me since. But at last, today, I remembered that hill. It lies just to the left of the road north of Poughkeepsie, and as a boy, I stood before it for hours in wintertime. So, two great poems. Now let me go to some smaller things. Of Mion. Fado is a musical genre called the Blues of Portugal. This poem is called Fado. Suppose my heart had broken out of its cage of bone, its heaving grill of rumors, my metronome, my honeycomb and crypt of jealousies long since preyed on, played out, my spoiled prince. Suppose then I could hold it out toward you, could feel its growling hound of blood brought to heel, its scarred skin grown taut with anticipating your touch, the tentative caress or sudden clutch. Suppose you could watch it burn, a jagged crown of flames above the empty rooms where counterclaims of air and anger feed the fire's quickening flush, and into whose remorse excuses rush. Would you then stretch your hand to take my scalding gift? And would you kiss the blackened hypocrite? It's yours. It's yours, this gift, this grievance embedded in each, where time will never matter and words can't reach. This poem was actually commissioned a long time ago by the New York Times editorial page, and it's called Jihad, which they had asked me to write about. And the night before it was to run, I'd read the proofs of it. I got a telephone call late at night from somebody on the editorial board that they say they decided that they wouldn't run the poem after all because they didn't want to disrupt the situation in the Middle East. And I burst out laughing. Could you imagine a poem doing such a thing as that? But never mind. So this poem is Jihad, and it has two stanzas, and then followed by two other stanzas, which are from the Quran. I've actually read the Quran, one of the most boring books I ever plowed through. Not as bad as the Book of Mormon or others, but pretty long and pretty dull. So this is a sort of pastiche of the language, of the beautiful some beautiful poetry from the Quran. Jihad. A contrail's white scimitar unsheathes above the tufts of anti-aircraft fire. Before the mullah's drill on righteousness, practice rocks are hurled at chicken wire dummies of tanks with silhouetted infidels defending the nothing both sides fight over in God's name, a last idolatry of boundaries. The sirens sound, take cover. He has forced the night and day, the sun and moon into your service. By his leave, the stars will shine to light the path that he has set you to walk upon. His mercy will let you slay who would blaspheme or from afar defile his lands. Glory is yours, O Sun. Of the heart, of the tongue, of the sword. The holy war is waged against the self at first. To raise the ziggurat of sin we climb upon to view ourselves. And next, against that glaze the enemies of faith will use to disguise their words. Only then, and at the caliph's nod, are believers called to drown in blood the people of an earlier book. There is no God but God. He knows the day of death and sees how men will hide. Who breaks his covenant is cursed. Who slights his revelations will live in fire. He has cast aside the schemer and the liar who mistake their emptiness of heart for a thirst that, to slake, the streams of justice descend. Ski-masked on videotape, the skinny martyr reads his manifesto. He's stilted, nervous. An hour later, he's dropped at the market town, pays his fare, and climbs aboard the bus. Strapped to his chest is the death of 34, plus his own, civilians on their way to buy or sell what goods they claim are theirs, unlike our fates, which are not ours to say. Under the shade of swords lies paradise. Whom you love are saved with you, their souls in his hand. And who would want to return to life except to be killed again? Who can thrive on the poverty of this world, its husks and hulls? His wisdom watches for each sacrifice. This is an odd poem, but you'll bear with me. One is always interested in those syllables that I don't think they are in the dictionary, but that function as words, although they're just sounds like psst and we all know what they mean. We know exactly what the meaning of those sounds is, and there's a huge range of them in our language and every language. And I was interested to discover by accident one day that the word er, as in hesitation, is also the name of a character in Plato's Republic. Er. So this is a poem about hesitation of various sorts. First, the hesitation of wanting to break up with somebody and waiting so long to do it that he did it to me. the second part is the story of Er. And the third part, which combines these two, is about myself in Plato's Republic, where after your death, different afterlives are laid out, I suppose, on pieces of paper on the field in front of you, and you can pick the life you would like to have next. And I happen to pick a bird. You'll see why. And so this voice is in the... that part of the poem is in the voice of the bird that I will be next time around. So first about the hesitation. I hesitate to mention now the time I hesitated. Was it weeks or months before telling him I was leaving for good, so that in the end it was he who left me, and my fear of his decision, well, of his tonelessly announcing it one night. Only that, always that, has clouded the scene, not unlike the way the years of happiness until that day, all of them a delusion, had prevented my recalling just how long I'd waited to discover my feelings at the start. 2 weeks, no, maybe less, on my own. Secret cell phone calls, a rented post office box, the desperate joking, the passionate or else's, seemed only to discover the nowhere I lingered in, the time I wanted to postpone hurting myself or him, the time I wanted to wait until I could turn into something he would never leave. Years later, forcing me to divide the shoebox full of snapshots or the letters from our long-dead companions, he waited while I chose through tears the things I didn't want to see, and did not look back through the closing door, though it only seemed as if he were standing there and I was falling back to a time when I couldn't delay any longer, the time I leaned down to select my lot, lying there on the ground in the field where I recognized so many others waiting their turn. In Plato's Republic, there is an explanation of this. 12 days after his death in battle, the body of son of Arminius, a hero of legend in far Pamphylia, as torches were readied, came to life again on his funeral pyre and told what he had seen of the other world. That his soul, in a crush of companions, had journeyed to a mysterious place, two openings, it seemed, in the earth, and two others above. Between them, the seats of judges who bound men to their sentences, that they should climb or descend, the symbols of their deeds fastened to their backs. But was told only to watch and bear the message back to men. He saw the dead arrive, dusty with travel, and the souls of those already saved stepped down into the meadow to meet them. Those they who knew one another embraced and wept at tales of what they had endured and seen, while those above told of delights to come, of injustices reversed, of tyrants cast into terrors worse than they that had themselves inflicted. Ur then looked up at a column of light to which the chains of heaven were attached that held the spindle of necessity, its eight hollowed whorls broadening in spangled ranks of wheeling planetary orbits, moving as they must, each sounding a note in harmony with the rest, and the fates adding their overtones, their hands touching, turning, guiding the spindle through its past, its present, its future. As Air looked on, each mortal soul was asked to choose its genius. The first were told not to be careless, the last not to despair. Each would have the lot of his desire, the length of a new life. Air stood in astonishment as one after another, men and women, because the memory of their previous lives was still so strong, asked to be animals in the next. No matter bird or beast, a blameless, unknowing being not in love with death. The soul that had once been Orpheus chose the life of a swan, not wanting to be born of a woman, hating the race of women who had murdered him. Others chose sparrow or horse, or, remembering their pain, an eagle that could circle the slain in their bloody armor, slowly circle high over what men do to themselves. Then each was given a cup of unmindfulness, from which some carelessly drank too much and some too little, so that the past would haunt them. Air himself was kept from drinking, and how his body was returned, he could never say. But as the others were driven like stars shooting up to their berths in the world, torches were lit, and Air suddenly woke and found himself lying on a pyre, his old parents in tears. In the end, because I took too long to decide, the bird lives on the ground there to choose from meant I would have to live far from home. I chose the farthest, the common tufted warbler, native to the Maghreb, a small bird the size of a fist, the color of wet sand, my tail brushed with berry stain, my crest opening to the sides, its fan of mandarin barbules gemmed with black incipient beads, my call a calling, errand, errand, errand. I can fly to find direction out and sing only to attract the echoing air, but my task an hour before dawn is to help summon the half-hearted day from its sleep as the dark begins to tip reluctantly. My limping chur, its admonition falling into place, glides through the oasis citrus grove, switches of scrub beginning to stir and stretch, to remind who hears it there is work to be done, word to be sent ahead of happiness, of noon on an iridescent scarab wing, of the dank leaf mold and warted rind, of the peace in our hours now, for all but them, those humans who shout and slash and smell of flesh. One of them stands alone every morning, looking into water, silently moving his lips. I stay to keep watch, and something comes back, a sense from some other life that because he has never been hurt, he is impossible to love. For now, he is my errand. Let me read a couple of short poems, or shorter. This one is called The Agave. You all know the big plant. The villa's switchback garden path between the potted railing and the sea and under a canopy of overlapping pines winds through what can grow under them. Plants from a moon orbiting Venus, maybe. Brambly fig, yucca, holm oak, firethorn, and silvery bloated succulents. The agave beside the stone bench where I have sat heavily all day, reaches out in all directions, its meaty, grizzled leaves, each the length of a man, each edged with back-turned venomous thorns, thumbnail billhooks in ranks down from the empurpled spike at its tip. The largest leaf, right next to me, has so bent under itself, the spike has come around and gone up through another part of itself, the heart, say, or whatever comes to as much as that. Yesterday, the gardener told me it could take 30 years for the spike slowly, never meaning to, thinking it was headed toward the water glare it mistook for the little light that kept not coming from above, slowly to pierce its own flesh, to sink its sorrow deep within and through its own life. It only took me a month. Here's another one in this group. This is called Little Elegy. But now that I am used to pain, its knuckles in my mouth the same today as yesterday, the cause as clear obscure as who's to blame, a fascination with the flaws sets in, the plundered heart, the pause between those earnest, oversold liberties that took like laws. What should have been, I never told, afraid of outbursts you'd withhold. Why are desires something to share? I'm shivering, though it isn't cold. Beneath your window, I stand and stare. The planets turn, the trees are bare. I'll toss a pebble at the pane, but softly, knowing you are not there. Maybe just for variety's sake, let me just read a couple of little versicles that are not quite so gloomy as the others. It's from a longer group just put together called Lingering Doubts. I don't know, that title has absolutely nothing to do with anything, but it had to have a title. Come back around on itself the evening. The honeybees dance and are understood, but their point is always and only nectar. Achilles spoke with the gods, and all they wanted was his spear through Hector. From prehab to retox in under a year, the cynic had run his terror to ground. The man in the mirror was merely glass. The world was just another round. The woman giving birth was standing near a bed, the child apparently worth the risk that lay ahead. "Don't be stubborn. Here, lie down," he crossly said. She winced and shook her head, spoken just like a man. "Lie down? A bed? That's where the trouble first began." The day he left, he said, "I knew the reason. Look at the trees. Love only lasts a season. For years since then, I've stared at them and seen only their blackened branches beneath the green." Let me give you the three-poem warning. I'll give you two short ones here. I'm one of those, I know there are poets who the title is the last thing they put on a poem. I'm one of those sorts who can't begin unless I have a title and keep, Wallace Stevens did the same, notebook, pages after pages of possible titles for things, and eventually hoping that to one of those titles, a poem will occur at a point. And you also keep, as any writer, I keep a little notebook of things that might be useful as epigraphs even. I have always like, and there was one in my notebook that I had kept for the longest time, meaning sometime to write a poem about it, and finally just gave up and wrote one. It's by Willa Cather, one of everyone's favorite authors, who said once, "I like trees because they seem more resigned to the way they have to live than other things do." this poem is called Resignation. Here the oak and silver-breasted birches stand in their sweet familiarity, while underground, as in a black mirror, they have concealed their tangled grievances, identical to the branching calm above, but there ensnared, each with the other's hold on what gives life to which is brutal enough. Still, in the air, none tries to keep company or change its fortune. They seem to lean on the light, unconcerned with what the world makes of their decencies, and will not show a jealous purchase on their length of days, to never having been loved as they wanted or deserved, to anyone's sudden infatuation gouged into their sides, to all they have forced to shelter and to hide, they have resigned themselves. I'm sorry, there's one thing, just for my friend Michael DeLyra, who kindly asked if I would read a very short poem. Actually, it has called Mercury Dressing. I was at Sotheby's some years ago. There was a sale. It was a Bill Blass estate sale. And there were some wonderful drawings and paintings by Pavel Chelichev, a painter whose work I love and I've tried to collect. And there was one drawing of his that I particularly wanted. It was on the cover of the book about Chelichev that Lincoln Kirstein had written some years ago. And I was determined to get that. The prices had not been going so high, but when this lot came up, damn it, somebody on the other side of the aisle just kept going and going and going. And the price had finally gotten up to, say, $5,000. And I honestly didn't think the drawing was worth that much. And I stopped bidding. The other guy won. I was furious. So I bought automatically the next item that came up for sale, even though I didn't particularly like it. I was just so angry at having lost the one that I wanted. But on the way home on the subway, I wrote this little poem about the one that got away. I don't think the drawing had a title, I referred to it as Mercury Dressing. It was of a figure. He had some sort of shorts on. He was leaning over, and he had a tin hat that looked like you'd see on the god Mercury in the various statues. Mercury Dressing. To steal a glance and, anxious, see him slipping into transparency, the feathered helmet already in place, its shadow fallen across his face, his hooded sex its counterpart, unsteadies the routines of the heart. If I reach out and touch his wing, what harm, what help might he then bring? But suddenly he disappears, as so much else has down the years, until I feel him deep inside the emptiness, preoccupied. His nerve electrifies the air. His message is his being there. Here's I'll just read one new poem and one older one. This poem from last month. As a matter of fact, where Barbara and I live in Stonington, on the way into town, one of our good neighbors has planted huge, vast field of sunflowers. Really quite remarkable. You're not used to seeing that in Connecticut, of all places. And it's of a beauty that is really breathtaking. But this poem is called Sunflowers in October, when the flowers are this big, the heads of these. I mean, some are normal sunflower size, but some grow to these. And when at the end of the season, they are all bent over. Sunflowers in October. Even on this first leg of the forced march into winter, the rows of ragged troops in the field can barely stand, their wooden stumps hollow as promises, their petals blasted, their bristled leaves now pained by parasites, their huge black catacombs all drooping in shame that they had not been picked in time. Many have already collapsed into the runnels of mud that generations have laid down for them. Asked what he meant by them, Van Gogh said it was not the flares or disc of dark seeds. It was how I painted gratitude, he said. Oh, death, I am grateful too, even for you. Rarely swift and never final, you drive everything that has dared to look up. Everything. You drive those proudly massed in strength against you. Drive those who plead to quicken or grace or blaze. You drive me as well to fall in line. And I will. Now, one last poem, a little longer. This is a kind of story poem. Which begins with a couple hostile and wanting to split up until, by accident, in the kitchen one night, one is doing the dishes, the other is suddenly appeared in the doorway, and the one doing the dishes turns around, and by accident, they look into each other's eyes and suddenly realize why they had fallen in love in the first place. Here at the very moment when they have decided to split apart. That leads to a real story, though very much elaborated here, that takes place in medieval Japan. And the poem is called A View of the Sea. The argument had smoldered for a week, long enough for the fine points of fire banked from the start against self-righteousness to have blurred in the pale ash of recrimination. I couldn't tell which wound would be the deeper, to stay on behind the slammed door, forcing you to listen to me talk about it with others, or to leave you altogether. What caused the argument, another crumpled piece of paper with a phone number on it, felt at last as lost as all the bright beginnings years back. And then you were standing at the sink with your back to me and must have sensed me there behind you, watching. Suddenly you turned around and I saw in your eyes what all along had been the reason I loved you and had come to this moment when I would be forced to choose but could not because of what I had seen. As when the master of the tea ceremony, determined to embody his ideal, had constructed a room of such simplicity that only a decade of deliberating its angles and details was, in the end, required of him. A wooden floor so delicately joined that birds still seemed to sing in its branches. Three salmon-dyed silken cushions on which the painted quince petals trembled. A pilled iron kettle disguised as a sea urchin. Each cup the echo of cloud on wave. And on the long, low wall, a swirling mural of warlords and misty philosophers, the 10 most famous men in the world. Floating at its center, the gold-leafed emperor, who, rumors having reached the court, was invited to come approve the great design. But when he saw himself as merely one of 10, declared that because the master's insult was exceeded only by his skill, he would be allowed to take his own life and have a month to plan the suicide. The master bowed, the emperor withdrew. At the month's end, two aged monks received the same letter from their old friend, the master, who had now built his final tea house, an improvisation, a thing of boards and cloth on the mountain in the province of their childhood, inviting them for one last cup together. The monks, too, wanted nothing more, the sadness of losing their friend to his ancestors eased by the ordinariness of his request. But they were feeble and could not make the climb. Again, the master wrote, begging them to visit. He was determined to die the very day they came and in their company. And besides, he reminded them, from the mountain they would have a view of the sea, its round immensity, the soul's own, they could never elsewhere command.
The two monks paused. Their duty to a friend was one thing, but to have at last a view of the sea, a wish since each had been a boy bent over pictures of its moon-swept midnight blue. So they agreed and undertook the difficult journey. Sheer rock, sharp sun, shallow breaths, until they reached the top. The master was waiting for them, the idea of leaving life already in his looks, a resignation half solemn, half smiling. He led them past a sapling plum he noted would lean in the wind 100 years hence. A small ridge still blocked the sea, but the master reassured them that it would be theirs, a memory to return with like no other, and soon, soon. They came to his simple house, a single room, but surrounded by stunted pines and thick hedges they could not see beyond. Patience was urged. Inside, they were welcomed with the usual silences, with traditional bows and ritual embraces. At the far end of the room, the 2 cups of water on the floor, the master explained, were for them to purify their mouths with before the tea was served. They were next told to lie on their bellies and inch towards the cups, ensuring a proper humiliation. The monks protested. They had come to see their friend through to the end, to see his soul released, poured like water into water. And where, after all, was the unmatched view he had promised them? They would, he countered, all have what they wished if they yielded as they must to this ceremony. The master waited. The monks slowly, painfully got to their knees, then to the straw mat, their arms outspread as they had been instructed, and like limbless beggars made their way across the floor, their eyes closed in shame until they reached the cups. With their lips, they tipped the rims back so the water ran over their tongues. "Now," the master whispered, "now look up." They opened their eyes, they raised their heads a little, and when they did, they saw a small oblong cut into the wall, and beyond that another cut through the hedge, and beyond that was what they had waited for all their lives, a sight so sublimely composed, 3 distant islands darkly shimmering on boundlessness, that in the end they saw themselves there, in their discomfort, in a small opening, in a long-planned accidental moment, in their rapture and their loss, in a view of the sea. Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. Thanks so much.